Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast. Trent and Leighton Kling with you this week. We've got a lot of news to discuss from perhaps more obscure retailers, including more of a movement towards brick and mortar for Warby Parker, a specialty eyewear retailer, and increased same-store sales expectations for Lids, the mall staple. But first, we begin with eBay, as they report their fourth quarter earnings that ended up right with analyst and company expectations. They also mentioned that they were able to bring in an additional 2 million active buyers across their platforms over the last quarter. So when you look at eBay, many of these additional buyers likely international because they see international sales growth tick upward slightly. Their domestic sales still under 40% of their overall sales, at least for their marketplace platform. eBay, of course, has the marketplace, has StubHub, and has their classifieds platform, which does most of its business outside of North America. And when we look at eBay, we can see certain fluctuations and that type of thing, but it also looks like their earnings per share might be inflated somewhat because of a couple of different factors: repurchasing of stock and also a sold stake in a company from Mexico.
Yeah, that's right. They did sell a stake in Mercado Libre, which is a company that is based in Mexico. They got a $0.8 billion gain from that sale of their equity holdings in that stake. And so you're looking at a company here that really does have inflated numbers through their net income. But if you look overall at the non-GAAP measure, the non-GAAP earnings per share, they came in at 54 cents, which, as you mentioned, was really in line with analyst expectations and was kind of at the higher end of company guidance. And then also revenue from continuing operations came in for the company at $2.4 billion. If you look at this number, you can see that the revenue increased year over year by about 6%. But the number that I wanted to focus on was the gross merchandise volume, or the amount of total transactions that the company had processed during the quarter. That was up about 5% year over year to $22.3 billion. And what's interesting, Trent, is if you look at the revenue for the company, you can see it's up 6%. But by contrast, the gross merchandise volume was up 5%. This means that they're actually having a better ability to monetize these transactions. So marginal revenue is actually growing faster than the marginal transaction values. This means that they're operating and executing at a very high level. And this is really good considering that this quarter includes a strong and very competitive holiday season. So again, earnings per share from continuing operations, including the sale and some tax settlements, was $5.9 billion or $5.31 per diluted share. And this is on the GAAP basis. And then also, you have a company that is able to produce $5 billion in gross merchandise volume here in the United States, but $14 billion internationally. And this is something that you had mentioned where they're being able to grow at a very high rate. Domestically, eBay seems to have stagnated. You're saying that this $14 billion internationally is from their marketplace platform, 1.9 million of its total $2.5 billion in revenue came from its marketplace platform overall. 79% of their business is still the marketplace. So while they have StubHub and they have their classifieds platform, the majority of their business, to the tune of about four-fifths of their business, is from the marketplace platform, the platform that most of our listeners are very well acquainted with. Then also, you can see that eBay generated $484 million in free cash flow for the quarter, which is an extraordinary amount. And then they also were the second highest visited e-commerce site in the United States.
I'm glad you mentioned the value of all their products sold on all of their platforms, both between their classifieds, their StubHub platform, and their eBay platform, because unlike other retailers that we talk about on this show, eBay is really kind of a pass-through retailer. Their money comes from when they can seal the deal in terms of connecting buyers and sellers. Amazon and to an extent other companies such as Walmart have this agreement with third-party sellers, but eBay gets a vast majority majority of their income from simply marketing products from these third-party sellers. And that's the number that I think we're really interested in as far as the podcast is concerned. Their GMV, or gross merchandise volume, which, as you mentioned, rose 5% year over year. Now, all that being said, I think some of the enthusiasm could stand to be tempered somewhat, because even though their marketplace did bring in $1.6 billion in terms of overall net transaction revenue, this reflects an increase of only 1% over the same quarter last year. And we should also keep in mind that that quarter last year is a pretty low comp in terms of the overall marketplace net transaction revenue. That comp was $1.584 billion, but that represented a 5% decrease over the quarter ending December 31st, 2014. So something to keep in mind is that there was some slackening in terms of overall revenue pass-through for eBay during the last calendar year or so, and it seems like they're heading in more of a positive direction, but I think there are still some warning signs there for eBay. However, helping out the company as a whole was StubHub. They saw an 18% increase in net transaction revenues over the prior year quarter. And StubHub, not really a retail business necessarily, more of a ticket broker business online. They saw their revenues jump from $232 million to $274 million over the previous year's quarter. And something to keep an eye on, if you see fairly bullish releases about eBay in the next quarter, it will be because StubHub is going against fairly weak comps. When we look at the comps from the quarter ending March 31st, 2016, we see that StubHub only brought in $177 million in net transaction revenue. Still a lot of physical money, but not nearly as much as the $274 million brought in the most recent quarter. And even though there are some fluctuations in terms of season with StubHub, because ticket sales go more or less year-round, you shouldn't see that large of a drop-off. So if they can come back with, say, $220 or $230 million in net transaction revenues from StubHub, that should help to inflate whatever numbers they bring in from eBay. And again, eBay, for the second consecutive quarter, their marketplace is operating against some fairly weak comps from the quarter ending March 31st, 2016. As we talked about, they have really three different places they can get money from. They get revenue coming in not only from their marketplace and from StubHub, but also their classifieds, which operate almost exclusively outside of the United States. Their percent revenue from international forums is 100%, is listed on their financials, whereas something like the eBay marketplace is 62% and StubHub is only 3%. However, it is important to note that the percentage of overall sales for StubHub from international sources has gone up. So that's something to keep our eye on as well. However, in terms of long-term fiscal strength of eBay, we know that obviously they're buying back shares. That's something that we've already mentioned. We know that they sold off a stake in Mercado Libre, and that's positively affecting their earnings per share. But the question for eBay is, how do they fight this domestic stagnation that they're experiencing? The growth in their marketplace concept has been somewhat tepid, and most of their growth in terms of net transaction revenue has been from StubHub. So how do they change their image domestically? How do they grow domestic sales? Because at this point, it seems like the only sales growth is coming from international sources.
So as we look a little bit more domestically at the marketplace platform, through this last quarter, we can see that they had strong success in fashion categories, home and garden, collectibles, and they cited stable growth in both electronics and auto parts. And auto parts is something you and I have been talking about for a long time, because you see a lot of brick and mortar retailers such as O'Reilly's and AutoZone really performing at a high level. But it's been known for quite some time that there's going to be some e-commerce players trying to take a chunk out of that market share. But as far as how they're working through the marketplace platform and trying to make it a more robust platform overall, because they are competing with the likes of Amazon, who is just massive at this point, they did mention some few things that I wrote down for this podcast. And so they've really tried to optimize their search engine optimization for related product searches. And then also they said that during the holiday season, they were able to bring in very strong traffic numbers because of this new SEO optimization. Also, you have with that an enhanced mobile platform that they've been working on for quite some time. And they said during this quarter, they actually received the highest reviews yet. So this is a really positive sign for a company that really has to have a good mobile experience if they expect to bring in additional traffic numbers, especially with strong comps from the last few years. Also, they have a structured data initiative that really is going to help bring in more product categories and make it easier for sellers to list items. There's a lot of categories that needed to be added, and they were able to bring in more categories overall during this last quarter. So they have a better structure now than they ever did before. And then also, they have several initiatives to simplify their seller platform. And that's one of the things that Amazon is known for, is that their Seller Central platform is really easy to use, and they bring in a lot of additional sellers sequentially. And this is something that eBay has had problems with in the past, really trying to simplify it and make sure that the common man can navigate their way through selling a product. This enhanced program also allows users to rate certain products in their catalog. And so far to date, they'd cite 20 million product reviews. And again, this is something, by contrast, that Amazon has done really well. This has driven Amazon's platform overall. You see that the reviews drive a lot of sales. You get a positive review of about 4.5 or above, you expect to see higher traffic numbers. Also, in 2017, they said they expect sellers with enhanced data tools to more effectively manage pricing, promotions, and inventory. And so obviously inventory is key here. And this, again, not to cite Amazon too many times, but is something that Amazon's been pushing for quite some time, as they oftentimes help sellers manage their inventory and also have obviously fulfillment assistance when needed. Through marketing, they cited strong social media campaigns, and they actually had their first ad TV campaign in the fourth quarter that was the first one since 2014. So believe it or not, it's been about 3 years since their previous TV ad campaigns were rolled out. We move on to a company that operates several mall staples such as Lids and Journey, and this company is Genesco Incorporated, and they announced and reported decreasing aggregate same-store sales for its banners in its most recent quarter to date. They also reset their earnings per share guidance for their fiscal fourth quarter. Analysts are looking for the retailer to report its fourth quarter earnings around March 10th. They last reported their earnings on December 2nd. It was a Friday. Their third quarter earnings were fairly decent. The company reported earnings this last quarter of $1.28 per share, topping analyst expectations of 93 cents per share. So this was a very good positive sign for the company. And the business also earned $711 million for this last quarter versus analyst expectations of about $716.8 million. Genesco overall had also a very positive return on equity of about 10.1% and a net margin of 3.34%. So the company was operating at a very high level, again, coming in above analyst expectations overall. However, you see these same store sales that came in for this report. Again, this was leading up to January 5th for the quarter. The quarter actually ends January 28th. And so again, they will be reporting around March, but the same store sales trend actually looked to decrease for the quarter. Aggregate same-store sales decreased about 2%, and sales for the company's e-commerce and catalog direct sales businesses increased 11%. By contrast, you see that Journeys reported a negative 6% same-store sales comp, and then the company's shoe that they have that sells in the UK was up 1%, Lids up 8%, and Johnston & Murphy, which operates several retail outlets throughout the United States and has an e-commerce business, was down 1%.
These comparable store sales numbers are simply quarter to date, so this would include November, December, and part of January, which may not reflect the exact comp sales numbers that we'll get in the final earnings release. So we see the negative 6% for Journeys. This is where the company gets the majority of their revenue from. When we look at their release from last year's fiscal fourth quarter, for the quarter ending January 3rd, Journeys brought in a significant amount more money than Lids did. Journeys came in at $403 million, and Lids came in just shy of $300 million. So much more money coming in from Journeys in terms of revenue. Also, Journeys tends to be a higher margin business. Last year's fiscal fourth quarter for the group, Journeys brought in an operating income of $53 million, whereas Lids brought in an operating income of $10 million. So the bad news for this company, Genesco, is that their higher margin retailer is shrinking in terms of same same-store sales. However, and not to make excuses necessarily for them, they are going against very difficult comps. Last year's fiscal fourth quarter saw same-store sales increases of 4.4% across the board, and this includes a 5% increase in the Journeys group. So not a surprise maybe that they back off of very strong comps, but I think it is a surprise to the extent at which they're backing off, which is negative 6%. Part of the headwinds for Journeys, in addition to all the hubbub about mall traffic we hear on a consistent basis, is that one of their most popular items, the Converse tennis shoe, is now available in multiple other outlets. And we see Converse outlet stores also popping up around the country as they begin to have more of an off-price presence in various different outlet malls. This is eroding and hurting Journeys sales. This is a product that they've been able to differentiate themselves on in that oftentimes, they are one of the only mall staples that will sell these increasingly popular Converse shoes. So Journeys saw a backing off in terms of their comparable store sales in store. That being said, their direct sales business, their e-commerce business did increase 11%, and I expect across the board this to mean positive things for Genesco as a whole. What I want to focus on here is Lids, and this is a business that I mentioned on last week's Retail Focus podcast as an example of a mall retailer that's doing very fine work in today's mall landscape. They had a same-store sales increase in their last quarter. In fact, their same-store sales increase came in at about 2% in that third quarter release that Leighton was referring to earlier. And the important part about that quarter is that's the first full fiscal quarter under which David Baxter was overseeing Lids Sports Group. Earlier this year, in fact, in May, David Baxter was appointed president and CEO of Lids Sports Group underneath Genesco, and he was also named a senior vice president of Genesco. That was effective June 1st of 2016. That fiscal third quarter was really the first where Baxter was able to get in and begin to implement some of his concepts, some of his ideas. The reason this is substantial for Lids is because Baxter has a very long career in the athletic apparel industry. He served as president in the sports license division at Adidas and Reebok from 2006 to 2014. He's had his hands in a lot of different merchandising aspects for sports apparel and for athletic gear. So he knows his stuff, basically, is what I'm saying. We see 2% same-store sales gains for Lids in the last fiscal quarter that we have data for. And now we get comps at 8% for Lids, which is eye-popping. You could see that Baxter has had a massive influence. Also, they attribute this same-store sales increase slightly, at least in this quarter, to the Cubs World Series victory, citing a lot of traffic surrounding the excitement regarding the Chicago Cubs' first World Series victory in over 100 years. You have that combined with an increased emphasis on what is sometimes termed hat culture in the United States. And you can see that Lids has a very solid future. Now, the big question facing Baxter moving forward is how to make Lids a higher margin store. So how to be more operationally effective as they're increasing sales. And once they do that, it wouldn't surprise me to see that by the end of this next full fiscal year for Genesco, would not surprise me to see Lids overtake Journeys in total revenue being brought in. And this comes at a time when the company is again trying to emerge more in the e-commerce space. They're seeing success there. So if they can bring more people into their brick and mortar lid stores for hats and their related merchandise under David Baxter, I feel like this company is primed for success moving forward. Now you just have to figure out what you do with the Journeys brand that saw same store sales shrinkage more or less throughout the entire last fiscal year.
I really appreciated your deeper insight there on Journeys, and I think Lids will have the higher potential going forward for Genesco. You see that 8% same-store sales growth is quite good for an industry that has matured in recent years, but you see how leadership has really taken the handle of Lids and created a brand within a brand. You see that they're now offering a lot of NBA jerseys on their website, and their mobile platform really has been enhanced over the last 6 months or so. And then, as you kind of alluded to, their social media has taken off. They are trying to emphasize new trends and really taking advantage of things like the NCAA basketball that's been heating up as of late. So anytime a big sports team is in the news, for instance, you mentioned the Cubs World Series victory, that's going to be a very good plus for them if they're able to utilize their social media effectively. Again, you can see that the hat and cap industry is growing about 1 to 2% annually here in the United States. However, their same-store sales can grow beyond that, and their overall growth can go beyond that if they're able to market effectively and take advantage of new trending topics that might entice someone to spend money where they might not ordinarily do so. I think there's a lot of positive signs here, and on the last earnings call, management said they were hoping for increased sales on these trending topics, and so I think this is something that they will be taking advantage of. If you look at the market overall, the hat and cap market here in the United States is roughly $2 to $3 billion a year, and that's a massive market when you think of just a very small niche area in the fashion industry. You're talking about an industry that really has a lot of competitors, and then also if you're looking at those sales domestically, you're also taking into the account that there might be an influx of sales from overseas with something such as jerseys and hats and other sports apparel. They're one of the operators in this space that have such a fine-tuned niche, and I look forward to seeing if their same-store sales momentum can carry through the rest of January into the quarter ending January 28th. Also, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the story, they did readjust their earnings per share guidance for the full year. The earnings range for the company is on the higher end of previous guidance. They now peg earnings per share to be around $3.80 per share to $4 per share. And then also, equities research analysts from SunTrust Banks increased their quarter four 2017 earnings per share estimates for Genesco. They're looking for Genesco to report earnings of $1.77 per share for the quarter, up against their previous forecast of about $1.57 per share.
We get to our final story before our interview segment, and we look to eyewear retailer Warby Parker. They've reportedly made commitments to start selling more through brick and mortar. They want to apparently add 50% more locations over the next few years. Up until this announcement, they had 46 brick and mortar locations in the U.S. and two in Canada. Most of these locations are in larger markets. Domestically, you see markets like Chicago, LA, Seattle, and Dallas. Abroad, you see markets like Toronto as an example. Warby Parker, one of the retailers that began in the e-commerce space, they've kind of spread out through brick and mortar as the years have progressed. And this is a great story of an e-commerce retailer looking more towards brick and mortar to expand their presence in the United States.
They really do have a strong brand following. And this is a company that is still relatively new in the industry. This is a company that was founded in 2010, and they are headquartered in New York City. Warby Parker is known for the designs of their glasses and the in-house nature of them. And they sell directly to the customers, not sourcing out much in terms of the frames or lenses. And if you look, their pricing structure is fairly simplistic. And I think that is what draws a lot of customers to their e-commerce site and now their brick and mortar presence. But as of 2012, frames typically cost around $95 and have free shipping if you buy them online. But if you look now in 2017, the price point is still the same. So customers have come to know Warby Parker as a very excellent maker of eyewear and really a great distributor too. And so if you look at this new report, the specialty retailer, as you mentioned, is opening 25 new locations in the U.S. All will be opened in 2017. And so really the strategy here is to get into these bigger markets and do so in a timely fashion. And so the strategy that they're trying to employ is entering into larger metropolitan areas that may be somewhat familiar with their brand from their e-commerce website. What was interesting to me, though, is the fact that they are opening in several locations that they already have a presence in. For instance, LA and in the Miami area where they already have stores, they plan on having some additional locations there. But overall, if you look at the management's take on the brick and mortar locations, they're saying that they think retail is not dead. However, the experiences are dead, and they hope to reinvigorate brick and mortar by having an excellent customer experience dynamic. This is what they're going to be focused on going forward. And they did mention that even though they are expanding rapidly, they're going to be focused on creating an amazing amazing customer experience. So despite improving their location count by about 50%, the company is still focused on what they do best. And I believe that the website and their current brick and mortar presence has given them the experience and know-how to know how they're going to operate these new 25 locations.
Warby Parker differentiates themselves on the eyeglass front from the likes of America's Best through the idea of quality and also culture. So they're looking more at the style of their frames than necessarily a price point. Now, their price point is very reasonable, and they make a big deal about their $95 or starting at $95 price point on their website. A company like America's Best, which sells contacts and eyeglasses mostly in a brick-and-mortar setting, they've got a ton of locations. They have well over 200 locations in the United States already, and they compete well on price. They sell two pairs of typical eyeglasses for $69.95, and they include a free eye exam for that. And those price points aren't necessarily anything that Warby Parker is going to be interested in competing with, but rather Warby Parker is going to try and connote a better culture in terms of their corporate culture and also a more authentic experience and an authentic feel through their stores. And this is something that one of their co-founders, Neil Blumenthal, said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal over the last couple of weeks. He said, and I quote, "I don't think retail is dead. Mediocre retail experiences are dead," end quote. And this is something Layton alluded to when he was talking about the retail experience that Warby Parker wants to bring to the public. And I'm glad Blumenthal said this, because let's be honest here, we really need to kill off the idea that retail is dying. In fact, I was looking at stories about another online or e-commerce first into brick and mortar retail store in Duluth Holdings. And there's an article with the headline on Motley Fool a few days ago, and I read, "Can Duluth Holdings defy the death of retail?" Look, retail's not going to die. Unless everyone moves to the forest and starts making their own stuff, there will always be retail. But retail will change, and the retail experience expectations will change. That's the big difference. Retail isn't dying because you see news about Sears closing and Macy's closing. And really, Warby Parker should be applauded for moving into the brick and mortar space, because they're going against what is so often cited as dangerous in the retail industry in terms of expanding brick and mortar locations. It's very important for an e-commerce retailer like Warby Parker to have a brick and mortar location, because they can implement things like buy online, pick up in store, and they can interact with customers in an omni-channel experience. Everyone talks about an omni-channel experience, but an e-commerce-only retailer can't be omni-channel. They can't be personal. The staff outreach is somewhat limited for an e-commerce retailer, and yeah, you can disrupt and think outside the box as far as how you're going to conduct your customer service for an e-commerce retailer, but until you get a brick-and-mortar location, you can't be truly omni-channel. Warby Parker realizes that, and they also realize that oftentimes the talk about retail dying is blown out of proportion. They know that people always need eyeglasses, and they know that there is a certain subset of the population, even though their e-commerce presence is great, that would rather shop for eyeglasses in person. Now, Warby Parker has long had a fantastic try before you buy experience. In fact, they offer a home try-on where you can select 5 frames to test out over the course of 5 days. Warby Parker ships them out for free, and then you select which ones you would like over time and ship back the rest. That's a great initiative for an e-commerce company, but at the same time, they realize that sometimes it's best to go to an actual physical location, and this is a positive thing for a company that has grown by leaps and bounds. Despite being private, they're valued at about $1.2 billion, according to a round of funding that was created in April of 2015 by T. Rowe Price for $100 million. So, ultimately, you see Warby Parker making what looks to be a necessary move for them going forward, or at least a move that their management feels might help them in the long term, despite the fact that we hear all this negative news about brick and mortar locations hurting many retail businesses.
Yeah, and if we look at the success of Warby Parker, you can see that their valuation is warranted, and that last and potentially largest round of funding by T. Rowe Price was one of many rounds of funding that they had previously. And I think that this really speaks volumes as to how they want to grow going forward, because expanding their brick and mortar presence isn't free, and they're going to have to utilize a lot of capital in order to have a great omnichannel experience. And we all know that lease rates are going up as well. So they are expanding rapidly, and they are having this capital infusion, but I think this is a safe bet for the company that, again, has been operating at a very high level for about 7 years now. There have been rumors for about a year and a half that they are going to have an IPO. However, they are still a privately held company. The founders still have a stake in the company, and this would be a unicorn, however, if they did have an IPO this year. A unicorn is a $1 billion private company turning public, but I believe that they are going to stay private. If there's any indicator out there, I would say this last round of funding would be one of them, because I think they have enough capital to expand their operations in a safe manner. And as they expand, they're going to be having a fairly good contribution margin. And I think if you look at how they've been able to differentiate in the space that has just been around so long and is so mature, I think it really tells a lot about how they're going to perform in the future. Honestly, Trent, you alluded to this, their website is exceptional. They not only have the home try-on platform, but just the overall site mechanics are very well done. I think this is going to be helpful for them going forward. As you can see how different glasses look at different angles, they use a person to try on different glasses, and they also have different color options that you can see before you try on at home. And I think this speaks to how they want to engage with the customer. So not only can they have a really good customer experience at their physical locations, they're doing the most they can as far as an e-commerce business to make sure that people feel comfortable before they purchase a set of sunglasses or eyeglass wear. And then also their 30-day free return policy is in place, and they have free return shipping. And that's something that is another differentiator for a company, because you see a lot of other players in this space or in other segments similar to this not have free return shipping. It's one thing to have a try-on at home option, but it's another to have a 30-day free return policy with free return shipping. I am going to be excited to be seeing what the future holds for the company and if all of these 25 locations that they're opening in 2017 pan out for the company overall.
One quick other note on Warby Parker before we move on to the interview segment. They are excellent not only in terms of e-commerce site arrangement, but also in terms of marketing. The company introduced a monocle, what they call a Colonel monocle, and they partnered up with an artist, Craig Redmond. Redmond has a one-eyed character whose name is Darcel, and they partnered up with this one-eyed character named Darcel to help to market their monocle. They do a great job with it. In fact, Darcel has its own blog online, so they're able to connect with different things. And this is really the type of marketing that you look for in an e-commerce retailer. It's not outlandish in terms of being in your face. It's not overwhelming. It's a very clean site design, very good cross promotion efforts for Warby Parker. And I, like you, am excited to see where they go in the brick and mortar space with some of these same e-commerce concepts that they've got. Coming up, we feature an interview with Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen of Kylie and Christian Creative. They shot a documentary a little over a couple of years ago featuring the closure of a particular retail store. As longtime listeners of the Retail Focus podcast know, from time to time we get into businesses that are struggling or have gone bankrupt. And actually last year we talked to a couple of mayors who had their own Alco stores in their small towns closed down. And we were fortunate enough, about a month ago, we found a documentary called The Closing of Alco Store 208. It really is fascinating. You can go out on Vimeo, search for it, The Closing of Alco Store 208. It's well done, and we're very fortunate to have the producers and the director of that documentary with us today to talk a little bit about formation of this documentary and about, of course, the closing of this Alco store a couple of years ago. Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen, thank you so much for joining the Retail Focus podcast today.
Thank you for having us and for getting my name right.
Yeah. It was a good guess, I must admit, but we'll start out here. You know, obviously with Thomas Jensen, the store manager of this particular Alco store, Where did the idea for kind of documenting the last 10 days of this Alco store's existence come about? How was this hatched after you first found out about the store closing? And then how did you find out about the store closing?
It's kind of funny because I didn't make this very apparent in the documentary intentionally, but Thomas is my father. Actually, I make a cameo in the movie as one of the little children in the montage of photos of the grand opening. So I'd always, as an aspiring filmmaker, been interested in the world of retail just because I heard about it most nights over the dinner table. And so I toyed with different ideas and was even writing a screenplay about a retail manager. And at some point, I just found out his store was closing and, you know, was kind of paying attention to that process. And then he'd asked me at one point if I could come and just shoot some video of his store, mainly just, you know, for his own archival look back. And I started to think that there might be a story there. There might be something kind of interesting because it's a point of view, I think, that's not often seen. Is, you know, we hear about these things happening, and usually it's from the corporate level and not so much the ground level.
Building off of that a little bit, one of the interesting things about store closures, as you mentioned, so much of it is from the corporate level. It's about dollars and cents. We don't really talk about the lives of the store managers or the employees that are impacted. So as filmmakers, what did you guys find most interesting in just covering the human interest aspect of this store closure?
You know, as producer, I was on set, not as much as Christian, but every time I was in the store, even in the last hours of it, it was very much business as usual. That was very interesting to me, that it wasn't as I expected it to be. We wouldn't think maybe it would be mayhem, or I think Christian maybe thought your dad would break down more or something like that. But we were very surprised / impressed at how business as usual everything was at Alco until the very last minute. Would you agree?
Yeah. And I think, too, by kind of focusing on him and less the company and really trying to figure out why, you know, I feel like you get that elsewhere, and I really wanted to focus on him and how does one deal with something like this. You know, he'd been there for that particular store for 26 and a half years and that company for close to probably over 30, you know, and how do you kind of deal with that, and not even so much like a looking back on it, but in the moment, how are you dealing with that? It was interesting because, yeah, like Kylie said, it wasn't the way he was wasn't necessarily what I was expecting. I was expecting it to be a little more somber and maybe even him a little less willing to open up to the camera. But then I remembered who my dad was, and that's who he is, though. He's like, he lives for a good laugh. And I think it was obviously too a way for him to, I think, cope with it, you know, keeping that routine up. And then, oddly, I think his son being there, if it had been someone else with a camera, I don't know if I would have been able to get the honesty and the intimacy that I was able to get.
You know, Kylie mentioned something pretty interesting in that oftentimes when we think about store closures, we think about liquidation sales and we think about chaos and we think of, you know, messy shelves and all of that. As you can see in the documentary, there's not a whole lot of that. The store is clean and well kept up until its final hour, even past its closing time. And obviously there's a sense of ownership there that you get the sense of through the interviews with Thomas Jensen. But did that seem to carry over when you guys were on set with some of the other employees? Were some of the other employees taking ownership with the company until that very last day?
Oh, definitely, yeah. People who were with him at the end, I think there was at least one woman who had been there since day one. And there had been a few others who had been there for a few years, you know, and they could have left, and a lot of people did, and a lot of managers in the company left when it all kind of started. But yeah, I feel like the people who were there were very loyal to my dad and to the store, and I think that because of that attention to detail and taking pride, I think because Tom still took pride in that, that rubbed off on the employees. You know, he kind of continued to inspire them in however he had been.
He ran an immaculate ship. It was beautiful. So I think that was just the store motto. It was kind of, you know, live up to Tom's expectations. They did.
Oh, yeah. He was always waxing the floors. And I remember growing up a lot, like, oh, Dad has to go in early to go wax the floors. You know, he was always, that was, the appearance of his store was very important. He's very detail-oriented.
I want to talk a little bit about the videography now in the documentary. You guys are based in Minnesota, so you have a little bit of a drive out there to South Dakota where this Alco store is. How much in terms of your approach to the documentary, you know, did the crew kind of talk about this on the way out there, or did it take shape more once you got into the Alco? And what was your approach with shooting, you know, basically an empty store?
First of all, I'll talk about the approach to the empty store. I did have, you know, when you shoot a documentary, you don't know exactly what's going to happen. So it's hard to imagine shots that aren't going to happen. But I did know that I was going to be going into an empty store. And as a filmmaker, a cinematographer, as a business owner, we've done a number of videos for small businesses. And there's a kind of style out there of, you know, the DSLR with a slider and you make maybe the coffee shop look cool, you know, with some cinematic camera movements. And I thought it'd be interesting to kind of do what I would normally do, but of the empty stores, and not necessarily trying to make them sad, but just kind of show them as they are. And maybe there's a little bit of irony in that it's a cool jib shot of store closing signs rather than, you know, a store full of inventory. So that was kind of how I guess we approached the empty shelves. And I guess without getting too artsy with it, they are kind of a metaphor, I guess. You walk through there and you think, oh, this is a metaphor. For what exactly? I don't know. I guess that comes out when you start combining image with sound, whether it be music or with Tom's voice and what he might be saying. They kind of begin to play off of each other in interesting ways. You know, you kind of just gather as much as you can while you're there, because documentary is more so than I think scripted work is really built in the edit and trying to find kind of connections between what someone said and what you might have shot. The crew was pretty small. It was primarily me and a couple high school students from Milbank. When we were coming, my dad had brought up a high school student he knew of named Tanner Hackwith, who was interested in video, and he had some gear, and so I reached out to him and asked if he would be interested in coming and helping out.
He was invaluable.
And he was invaluable. You know, I sent him out in the store sometimes when I was interviewing Tom to get the footage around the store, and he operated the camera for me sometimes, you know, like when we were walking around the store sometimes, so that I could kind of focus on interviewing. And there was another kid there, JP Lindquist, and he ran sound for us when he was there. They were my crew, and I wasn't there the full 10 days. I think 4 total days of shooting, some full, some half.
That provides a lot of insight into the thought process there. I want to play a couple of clips from the documentary, and we'll start with this particular clip as Thomas Jensen is making the final announcement as far as the store closure is concerned. Let's take a listen here.
Attention, Alco shoppers. After 26 and a half years being here in Milbank, South Dakota, we will be closing. I just want to say thank you for just being loyal customers to us, and thank you for shopping at Alco. Thank you.
A lot of power in that announcement, and one of the reasons is because you kind of make reference, several references actually, to multiple announcements that the employees are making over the PA system, over the loudspeaker announcing the closing. And it seems like every time that announcement is made, it gives Thomas reason for pause. How much of an emotional roller coaster was this week for him? You mentioned he managed to keep his emotions in check somewhat.
For Tom, you know, I think because he was in charge of it, he still had to, you know, maintain, I think, you know, kind of put on that face of the leader. I didn't see, you know, there wasn't a moment where I overheard him in the other room, you know, sobbing or anything like that. But there's the moment, there's one moment when he does, we're in the store, we're talking about something, and he does kind of break down. But that was really the only time. And I think there's one point in the office where he talks about running the store as if it was his own and why he didn't leave. Those were really, other than that, he was real strong about it.
Well, and I think he, as he mentions in the film a couple of times, his faith is something that he's always really kept close to his heart, so it keeps him going. And I think he's the kind of person, just in the time I spent with him shooting and in life, he's the kind of person who really believes if something's happening to him, it's for a reason. And so I think he's good at seeing the bigger picture in something, even a store closing that he's managed for, you know, almost 27 years. He's still able to see but there's something bigger at work and it's not the end of the world. So we didn't know that about him necessarily before we went in. I think I learned that while we were shooting with him. I've interviewed a lot of people and I can get people to crack by asking them certain questions, and I think you can have that experience too. And he doesn't crack. I mean, he didn't crack up while we were filming. So unless he has some dark secret cry closet somewhere that we don't know about.
Yes, but we didn't see it. Yeah. I think honestly, you know, his employees, they were visibly more.
Yes, his employees were wrecked.
You know, that was something. And because I didn't get to spend a lot of time with them, that's maybe one thing that would have, I could have gotten more of something, I would have wanted to get just a little bit more interaction with them, but they were working and there weren't that many of them still around. But they tended to be the ones, if there were going to be some tears shed, they were the ones.
Now, I know you guys probably didn't spend a ton of time interacting with customers, but we've talked about Tom and his employees' reaction to it. What was the general sense that you got from the customers there in Milbank about the closing of this Alco store?
I think the community was worried that there wouldn't be another store like it. I think that was the biggest thing I heard in the aisles. You know, as we're walking through and Christian's shooting and I'm shopping the deals, it was clear that everyone was wondering what was going to happen next and if there was going to be another space for a store in that community, if there was going to be a replacement for Alco.
And I think they were really confused too, yeah, because the store was not unsuccessful. It still had really good sales numbers and there were still a lot of people, you know, like you mentioned, you know, not many of the stores in the company were losing money and his store definitely wasn't. So, you know, I think the community was kind of
puzzled.
There it was, you know, it came as kind of a shock. They didn't really know why. And I think that, and then, yeah, like she said, just they were kind of worried, like, what are we going to do now? Because it's also, it feeds the smaller community, because Milbank is a really small community compared to Minneapolis, but it's, for where it is, it's a bigger community in the area. And so a lot of people from those smaller towns come in to shop at Elko and the other, you know, grocery stores that they have and stuff. So that was another concern, was not just the people of Milbank, but the people outside of Milbank too.
If it makes you feel any better, I know a lot of people in the retail community were kind of confused by the entire bankruptcy and liquidation proceedings as well. Did the people of Milbank get another store? Has that location been occupied?
Yeah, it currently has a Shopko.
Yeah, Tom was actually, in his departure from Alco and in time in between, he was very influential in getting a Shopko put into the building. So I think there were even some things he had to overcome, like spatial constraints and size of the floor plan. And he had to really convince Shopko to get in the space. So, but Shopko's there now.
Yeah, they were kind of moving in on a lot of the Alco stores, those buildings that they were closing. And they didn't originally want to move into that store because it was a little smaller. But yeah, they were able to work that out and a few other things. But yeah, yeah.
He played a big part in that.
I think one of the strongest quotes in this from Tom Jensen, later on in the documentary, he says that retail is weird. It sucks you in. He also says that he can't wait to run another store. Is he still involved in retail in some way? What's Tom up to now?
Well, he has just become certified to sell insurance in South Dakota. So he's going to be selling insurance with Aflac. And he spent some time, he was selling cars in Milbank at a local dealership in kind of the in-between time. So I guess he has moved on from Shopko.
There's a brief period in time that it was maybe going to be his future to work at Shopko, but it was not a natural fit for him. So
It didn't pan out. Yeah.
But I think one thing we learned in making the documentary and getting to know Tom a lot better in the process is how much of his identity he did wrap up in the store and how it maybe didn't bring him as much happiness as he really thought it did. It took up a lot of his time. I mean, managing a retail store, as you've heard, I'm sure, is hard. It's not work for a man nearing retirement if he doesn't have it in him as much anymore. And so I think a lot of his job was not his favorite part of the job anymore either. So it's given him the opportunity to discover what he really does like to do and how he likes to spend his time. And I think working with Aflac is going to help him do that a lot more.
Well, yeah, it's a very, he started in retail when he was still in high school. And so from that point on until that store closed, he kind of knew what he was going to do. And yeah, he got the opportunity to think about what his life might look like another way. And that's not easy to do, particularly when it's kind of like forced on you. And there's some transition, but he's making that transition.
He's doing great.
Yeah, he's doing great.
I want to play one more clip from the documentary, and this is towards the end of the documentary. It starts off with a couple of fantastic questions. The question you asked just prior to this is, if you could ask Alco any question, what would it be? And then we have this question here.
If you could say anything to Alco, what would it be?
Thank you. Not thank him for closing the store. You know, that would be dope. Yeah, hit the career stopping. You know, that happens all the time in this world. You know what the hardest thing was so far? The last night of sales was punching in my security numbers. That was really difficult. I don't know why. It was like, I can't do it, you know? Because that was hard.
You get him basically saying something very similar to what you guys were saying, and that his identity was so wrapped up in Alco, very tough to move on, tough to punch in those security numbers on the last day in the store. And as you've mentioned, he has moved on, he has gone forward, but how does he still regard Alco, and then did he ever get answers to his questions?
The answers to his questions, he never got.
Did he still stay in touch with some of the other managers, though?
He does still stay in touch with some of the other managers.
Any of them get an answer to that question?
I don't think any of them did. I don't think any of them ever really asked. I think it was one of those cases where you have the question, but you also maybe know you're not going to get the answer. Because they had been told, you know, this, that, and the other thing, but I don't think that was it really. None of those could give a satisfying explanation to it. So, yeah, he hasn't gotten those answers. I think he does look back on the work and the people he worked with and the things he was able to do.
Because of that,
because he was the manager of Alco, he was able to do things in the community and be involved in that way. He saw a lot of people come through as employees. He had there was one woman I know who worked with him in the very beginning. You know, she was an associate and now she owns one of the restaurants in town, you know, so he also, you know, maybe played a role in people's lives in the community, and I think he feels really good about that. I think there's probably still some bad blood towards Alco. I know that there's also some outstanding workman's comp BS that they're dealing with too, you know, so there's some lingering, I think, frustrations there, but I think that he doesn't regret it.
I think he maybe would have wanted it to be on his terms more, but at the same time, I think that he can't help but be thankful to them for giving him such stability for all those years too. I think, you know, he stayed through until your sister was done with school, until all of that. So I think it's good. He remembers what it was for him in his life and for his family, and it afforded them the stability to do a lot of things.
You could say he's probably like an eternal optimist in that way.
He really is an eternal optimist. I mean, I don't think you could get him to say bad things about Alco.
I kind of want to ask you guys what you're up to now. I know you've got a website, kylieandchristian.com. Seems like there's a lot of great things, including the link to the Alco documentaries. What's next for you guys?
We actually are leaving tomorrow to shoot another documentary, which is great. It will be a 10-day documentary highlighting the Oda region, which, if you're not familiar, is all of the states that end in Oda, so Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And we will be meeting and working with 13 artists who will give us a glimpse into their world and why it's great to live, work, and thrive in such a very cold place. A cold and hostile environment that's actually great for the arts and great for community. And so we haven't met most of these people, and we are excited to hear their stories and wrap it all up in a documentary about Oda. So the project is called Oda, and you can go to weareoda.org to find out who Oda is. And it's already an organization that I didn't think of Oda. I wish I would have thought of Oda. Our dear friend Hugh Weber thought of Oda, so he's the one who is going to be joining us on this journey.
It's fantastic. It seems like an interesting time of year to be taking the journey as well.
That's definitely probably a mistake, but then also
it's a selling point.
But I think it'll make it even more interesting and add a layer of drama to it.
For sure.
Well, safe travels, guys. Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen, the producers and director for the documentary Closing of Alco Store 208. Thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That's once again Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen from Kylie and Christian Creative. that we're on to talk about their documentary, The Closing of Alco Store 208, which is available on their website, KylieAndChristian.com. You can watch it for free there. Really is an excellent piece of retail work insofar as documenting the closure of a retail store.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
It's a great interview with Kylie and Christian, really illustrative as far as their thought process going into that documentary. It's a fantastic documentary, and again, you can check it out on Vimeo if you search The Closing of Alco Store 208. We move on to the Retail Focus podcast with kind of a jumbo looking ahead segment, because we've got one story and then we'll each get to our individual stories that we're looking towards here over the next couple of weeks. But just as we reported Halloween spending trends and Thanksgiving spending trends, and we talked about holiday spending trends as well, we're looking ahead towards spending trends for Super Bowl weekend. Now, these expenditures typically affect grocery stores perhaps a little bit more than it affects other retailers. But, you know, a retailer we talked about in the first segment here on the podcast, Lids, is no doubt watching anxiously in the week leading up to the Super Bowl, and they'll be watching very anxiously to see who wins the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and a lot of people are going to be watching the Super Bowl. You see that since the Super Bowl was initiated, TV ratings have steadily increased. So the first Super Bowl was in 1967, and you see in 1968, they had an estimated 39 million viewers. Back in 2015, now 114 million viewers. These are average concurrent numbers. If last year was any indication, there are less people watching the Super Bowl. They had an 8% drop from 2015 to 2016. Only 111.9 million people watched last year, really indicating a reversal of those watching the big game. And I think it really is a factor of who is playing. Obviously, some teams are more popular than others. Last year, you had the Carolina Panthers versus the Denver Broncos. A lot of people weren't that interested in the game. And then you see the average viewership was down after halftime, after it became clear who the winner was going to be. But heading into last Sunday's conference championships, you could see that the NFL games have been averaging fairly good numbers, but were off 3% from last year. They were averaging 33.2 million viewers during the playoffs. And if this is any indication, we can see maybe a lower amount of viewers this year. We're talking about, again, 111.9 watched last year, perhaps a little bit less this year. I was looking through some analyst projections, and a lot are still saying that they're going to do well over 100 million viewers this year, but it's going to be a little unclear as to how much they're going to beat that number by. We can assume, though, that this really ties into consumer spending, and a report on that indicates that consumer spending is actually less that surrounds the Super Bowl activities.
And part of this is because the Super Bowl in and of itself, of course, is a product of the NFL. And we hear a lot about shrinking ratings overall for the NFL. Here you have a matchup featuring the Atlanta Falcons and New England Patriots, where the Patriots have been here and done that many different times. So you wonder if there's some sort of a burnout factor there. But we talk a lot about the Super Bowl as one of the major sporting events of the year. If there's not a World Cup, for example, in that particular year, if there's not an Olympics in that particular year, and we are in a year where there's obviously not an Olympic Games being played. So this is one of the major sporting events as far as retailers are concerned. And when we look at the overall ratings, we must keep in mind that some of the traditional ratings don't measure metrics of people watching through online streams or people watching live online. But as far as retail numbers, what retailers are looking at is how much consumer spending falls in this year. Consumers, it appears, will spend an average of $75 each during the lead up to Super Bowl week. It'll be a total of around $14.1 billion, according to the National Retail Federation's annual Super Bowl spending survey. And this is, again, in the lead up to the Super Bowl. This spending is down from an average of $82 per consumer and a total of $15.5 billion last year. However, part of that you should factor in food deflation for, and this is something we mentioned in the lead up to Thanksgiving week and preparing to purchase the Thanksgiving turkey and the cranberry sauce and that type of thing. Across the board, food prices are down. And of those surveyed who plan to watch the game, 80% say they will purchase food and beverages. So if you see price decreases of maybe it's 1, 2, or 3% across the board, that's going to put a big chip into the top line revenue of some of the leading grocers in the country. 11% of those surveyed will buy some sort of team apparel or accessories. And this is where I think companies like Lids and also other companies who sell athletic apparel, including Foot Locker, are paying very close attention. Again, the New England Patriots have been to the Super Bowl before. They won it just a few years ago on Malcolm Butler's last-minute interception against the Seahawks at the goal line. So the Patriots have been one of the longest-tenured dynasties, really, in the NFL since they won it the first time back in 2001. There may be a little bit of tiredness among consumers surrounding the New England Patriots. And this is why I believe for retailers, at least those that sell clothing and athletic gear, they are kind of hoping the Falcons win, in my opinion, because the Falcons, Atlanta is an up-and-coming area. They've become very chic and popular. In fact, Atlanta, one of the first brick-and-mortar locations for Warby Parker Eyewear, who we talked about in the first segment as well. And they have some excellent merchandise. The Falcons do an excellent job of merchandising their own team. So companies like Lids are maybe, perhaps hoping that the Falcons win because so many people already have Patriots gear. You maybe won't see as many first-time buyers of athletic gear if the Patriots win the Super Bowl. This would, of course, be the Falcons' first Super Bowl win. So while you won't have necessarily the Chicago Cubs effect here for retailers, you might have something similar to that if the Falcons can pull off what Las Vegas says might be an upset.
Yeah, and looking more into something that's not necessarily retail and has more to do with something we would most ordinarily cover on the Food Focus podcast, but this study has found that bars and restaurants can also expect a turnout of about 12.4 million people planning to watch the game. And so this really speaks to how a lot of restaurants might be trying to take advantage of these sales. So it's not just other brick and mortar retailers like Lids. A lot of restaurants are going to be trying to utilize this kind of event to bring in more traffic. You see Buffalo Wild Wings struggling in 2016. I'm sure they're going to have some strong social media campaigns to try to get viewers inside of their restaurants. Over 43% of viewers say the most important part is the game itself. But like we mentioned, a lot of people like to hang out together and go to restaurants and bars. 15% say they use the experience to hang out with friends or family. And then 24% cite the commercials. 24% of people really appreciate the commercials that have such high visibility during the Super Bowl. And then 12% say the halftime show is their top highlight. So a lot of interesting facts from this most recent survey. I argue that community is one of the more important things surrounding the Super Bowl. You can see that, again, a lot of people are buying a lot of food and food accessories, things like plastic silverware and plates. And I think that really has to do with the fact that they're not watching the game by themselves. They're watching it with family and friends, and they are using it for an opportunity to get together. And I think that is really what the Super Bowl is about. That is why the viewership is so much higher than the playoff time. I think playoffs represent about 1/3 of the numbers that the Super Bowl will get. That really speaks to how people use the opportunity to see their closest friends and family. Talking briefly a little further about the TV ad reception, the survey also found that 78% of viewers watch the commercials for the entertainment value, and 18% say they're more aware of the advertiser's brand. So that really speaks to how effective the marketing is. It's not really that effective, but it is a sort of entertainment, and there are a lot of staple brands that have decided to not have Super Bowl ads this year because of the high price point and low rate of effectiveness. But as we move on from all the numbers, Trent, I am really curious to know, who are you picking to win the Super Bowl? As of right now, 538.com has the odds of the Patriots winning at 61%, and I'm sure their fans are pretty stoked to see that high number.
Yeah, I think the Patriots are certainly the more favored team here. I know, just based on a canvas of people that I'm fairly close with, I know most people want the Falcons to win. I'm friends with a few huge New England Patriots fans, but I would have to say the Patriots probably win this one. It seems like they've had the better team throughout. However, what our listeners are probably more interested about is which retailer I think will come out on top as a result of the Super Bowl and Super Bowl merchandise sales. And I'm actually going to go with Foot Locker. Foot Locker has been extending their sales of NBA and NFL products out somewhat. And keep in mind, Foot Locker also has holdings in Champs Sports as well. So I say Foot Locker wins the Super Bowl this year, regardless of whether Atlanta or New England takes it.
Yeah, I actually believe that the numbers are correct here. I think the Patriots will most likely win the Super Bowl. They do have the sixth-ranked defense in the NFL, and like the Falcons, they do utilize a lot of their receivers. But as far as the retailer is concerned, I think a very large retailer such as Walmart, a retailer that sells a lot of sports merchandise accessories, is going to be the more profitable retailer during and after the Super Bowl. I think that not only the T-shirts, the Super Bowl winning T-shirts, but also things like keychains and posters and signs and things of that nature are going to have some very high sales.
Yeah, it's interesting. Neither one of us picked a grocery store as far as our winning retailer. A lot of that has to do, no doubt, with grocery deflation. One final note on this story before we move on to our typical looking ahead stories. One little known fact probably for the listeners of the podcast routinely is that I teach a sports media and society class, and I can tell you based on data over the last 5 to 10 years, you only see around 4 to 9% of people watch the Super Bowl by themselves. So it is very much a communal event, and that's why it's so impactful for retailers throughout the country. Well, as we mentioned, we wrap up this version of the Retail Focus podcast by each telling you about a story above and beyond the Super Bowl, of course, that we'll be looking ahead to over the next week or month. And we begin with Leighton.
Yeah, so my story has to do with 2017 as a whole, and a recent survey from TD Bank polled 173 retail executives at the National Retail Federation's annual big show in New York City that happened recently, and 74% of the retailers say they expect sales to increase for the year of 2017, and this is a really bullish statement considering there is a lot of news back and forth as to how retail is going to fare with the wage increases in a lot of different states. And then also you have food deflation potentially coming to a stop, but that could potentially hurt margins overall because people are so used to the lower food prices. And of course, that affects restaurants too. And then also 43% of retailers expect that customers will browse and apply and buy online in the next 2 years. And so this was up from previous numbers. So this really speaks to how executives are preparing for an omnichannel future. They're saying that a lot of customers are now going to the mobile experience to buy their items. And I think that utilization is going to just go up from here. But this is really good news for the retail industry. Again, as if you look at a lot of the media articles, it is not always positive.
My story that I'm looking ahead to has to do with a retailer that may indeed see a little bit of a bump during the Super Bowl in terms of grocery sales, and that is Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market has announced this week that it would close their 3 remaining regional kitchen facilities. They're trying to streamline their operations, so they're looking to suppliers to fulfill their ready-to-eat foods and pre-made foods needs. So this is an interesting step for Whole Foods in that they're exiting the vertical integration of this aspect. What's more is that we'll recall about a year ago, these kitchen facilities, or at least a few of them, were under fire by the FDA, citing some potentially harmful food safety practices. Although when you look at the note that was written in that circumstance, it seemed like it was blown out of proportion a little bit. That being said, it is an interesting step for Whole Foods as they try to improve profitability, and they look to do that by stripping away some of this vertical integration for the prepared food market. Now, that being said, it doesn't appear as though they're closing the actual kitchens or ovens that they have in their stores. They're still retaining that grocerant section of the stores, at least as of this moment. But I do find it intriguing that they are ceasing the creation of prepared foods, at least in-house. They'll be farming that out to suppliers. On news of that this week, Whole Foods stock popped about 2%. So investors seem to like that news, although I'm not sure how that'll play out long-term for the grocery retailer. That'll do it for us on the Retail Focus Podcast. Early next week, we'll come out with another edition of the Food Focus Podcast. Looking ahead to that, we'll talk a little bit about Bob Evans splitting their restaurant and packaged food divisions. Make sure and subscribe to that podcast if you haven't done so already. And you can follow us on Twitter for this podcast at Retail Podcast. Layton will be updating that daily with all the retail news you need to know on a day-in, day-out basis. So long, until next week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.